Okay, hi everyone. So we're just about to start our second panel on photographing disasters. So I'm going to pass it off to Annie to introduce everyone.
Hello everyone. Can everyone hear me? Is it quiet? Is it? Hello? Hello? Is this better? Okay, great. Hello everyone. I apologize for the technical difficulties, but we're here and we're ready to go. This is a panel that I've been super excited for a while. Today I am talking to some really incredible talent. If you're just rolling in now, this is the RIJ on Disasters Conference, where we're looking into the responsibilities of a journalist in the time of a natural disaster. Are they supposed to educate through their work? Are there ethical concerns involved in said coverage? And ultimately, what is the role of a photojournalist when covering a disaster? So next to me, I have, again, three really talented photojournalists and educators who are going to speak on their work. First up, we have Blake Fitzpatrick. So Blake actually has a little bit of a presentation that he's going to show us to kick things off. So Blake is a professor at the School of Image Arts. His research interests range from photography of the nuclear war era, post-Cold War history, and the Berlin Wall. And again, Blake actually teaches a course called Disaster Images, Memory and Response, which examines the response of photographers and artists during the time of a disaster. So Blake's gonna get this PowerPoint going really soon, but I'm just gonna introduce the rest of our panelists. Peter Bragg is sitting next to me. He is the man behind the famous mustache here at Ryerson. Peter has been all around the world taking photographs. He's flown to San Francisco in the wake of an earthquake. He's documented the despair following a tsunami for publications including Maclean's. And we're really, really excited to have him here today, as well as Blake. So welcome to you two. And lastly, but certainly not least, we have Ed Wu. Ed is based in New York, so he actually flew out to see us today, which is really great. Go Ed. Thank you, Ed. He works with NBC currently. He's worked with the New York Times and CBC in the past. After he graduated university, he did some work documenting the aftermath of the Soviet nuclear weapon testing crisis, which is super, super interesting. He's going to be addressing some of his photography via PowerPoint as well, so is Peter. So get excited. Please give these panelists a round of applause. We're really happy to have them here.
Okay.
Go for it, Blake.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Annie, and thanks, Sonia, for inviting me today. I'm going to really talk, I guess, more of an overview of some issues in photography related to the representation of disaster. And I want to start by saying that, you know, there can be no disaster without representation. And representation in disaster takes many, many forms. Put some on the board here, but you know, our concern today is really with photography. But photography doesn't mean any one thing as well. You know, there's photojournalism, there's documentary photography, there's art photography, there's technical illustration, which is photo-based. All of those things play into the disaster site, and show up over and over again. And there are certain tropes that we see over and over again, and certain kinds of images that return over and over again. Here's just some photographs from Hurricane Irene in Manhattan a couple of years ago, a photograph, but also an artist's illustration, which is an interpretation of the disaster. But in that act of interpretation, there's sort of echo effects of other images that we've seen. For example, the 9/11 disaster and some of the way in which the street was just transformed by the disaster. And my point in showing these two is to say from the beginning that sometimes one disaster image is imposed on another, that there are certain tropes that repeat over and over again. And the more you look at disaster images, you start to see patterns. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of those tropes or patterns. One of the things that we find is that where disaster occurs, witnesses follow. Or sometimes witnesses can't help but get out of the way. And so photographs of people seeing the disaster put a human perspective on the disaster and kind of measure response in terms of what the disaster might mean in human terms. And so that's why it's very, very common to see around disaster reportage and documentation images of people seeing the disaster, responding to the disaster, and also photographing the disaster. The disaster presents all sorts of problems for representation. On some level, it's beyond representation. It's beyond what any one person can see because of the scale of the disaster, but also the way in which disasters unfold in time. And photographs and photography are always, you know, locked to the moment. So how does one show in time a process unfolding around a particular disaster site? So it's interesting to see the ways in which various publications and online reports have actually tried to address these issues. For example, it's not at all uncommon to see an image, you know, from a disaster site that's from the Japanese tsunami from 2011. And in 2012, you could visit these sites, and there was a slider, and you could pull the slider, and it would show you simultaneously before and after. Actually, before in this case being the moment of the disaster, its aftermath in terms of really kind of putting things back to normal again. And sometimes it goes the other way. The before is before the disaster, and you pull the slider, and then you see the disaster in terms of what it has happened. But that idea of before and after is, I think, really important, and it follows around disaster representation over and over again. And in some ways, I think we need to see the aftermath photograph to show or perhaps be assured that things have come back to some state of normalcy, and also to show that the disaster is not a temporary effect or not a temporary event. It does unfold in time with implications that keep on moving. David McMillan is a Canadian photographer from Winnipeg who's been to Chernobyl probably 20 times since the accident in 87 and has photographed on a repeated basis some of the same sites. So for example, here, this is a stairwell in a school in Pepjet, which was the village set up for the workers at Chernobyl in 1996. And this is, you know, a display of the Soviet Union with all the flags representing different areas. And then, you know, coming back there in 2004, and we see the slow unfolding in time of what's taking place there, and then back again in 2016. So sometimes it's time itself that really is the photographic subject. Also, in terms of, you know, some examples here from the BP oil spill, where it's very hard to see an oil spill. I mean, there is a slick on the surface, but in terms of size, it's very hard to measure because on the open waters that you don't have the typical reference points to measure distance from. And that problem was addressed by various publications, and I've seen the same kind of thing taking place with the Fort McMurray fires, where a map of some kind of the extent of the fire, or in this case, the extent of the plume of the oil slick, is drawn on the Gulf, and then in an interactive display, you have ways in which you can plug in your particular landscape or your particular city, and it would show essentially what, you know, in comparative terms, the space would look like to give you a context to understand really what kind of scale are we talking about. So these questions of magnitude, questions of scale, questions of imaginability are always at work in the disaster. And, you know, there are certain kinds of formulas or tropes that start to emerge, one being the establishing shot in the detail, typically the overview, and then the ground truth. Or you might also think of this as cause and effect. Which is actually also very much a kind of temporal display of when it's happening and then afterwards. So those sorts of, you know, above and below shots happen all the time around disaster representation. Here, for example, a photograph by Ed Bertinsky that was in the Globe and Mail with the BP oil disaster, a big overview showing the extent of the plume on the slick on the top of the water. But those sorts of pictures, which were quite many, are always followed by the sort of ground truth of the disaster, the lived effects on wildlife and on humans and on landscape, you know, from a kind of ground perspective where those sorts of things can be known and not just seen. And what was most interesting also, I think, about the BP oil spill was not only did we have a view from above and a view from the ground, we also had a view from below to the site of the gusher itself. And as was written about by Peter Gallison and Caroline Jones, this ongoing, nonstop video web coverage of the incessant, you know, letting forth of the oil down deep down into the water was this kind of almost a kind of trauma image, a non-stoppable trauma image that just kept repeating over and over again. And it was really, in some ways, that was one of the most important kind of iconic images to come out of that, because of the way in which it spoke to things that actually a still photograph can't speak to, which is ongoing, nonstop time. Hurricane Katrina, again, a satellite view to establish the sort of scale, an overview to show the sort of, you know, the scale of the disaster. But those sorts of images, even the sort of massification of bodies displaced at the Superdome and then also in Houston at the Astrodome, these kind of massive pictures of like cot set up in a big arena, always matched with the sort of local ground truth of, you know, the individual. So these sorts of juxtapositions bring forth the scale, the massification, the sort of magnitude of the issue, and then also its human impact in sort of lived terms, in individual terms as well. I just want to end very quickly with a series of images by an artist, Richard Mishrash, who comes to New Orleans in October 2005, about a month after the disaster of the Hurricane Katrina. And really, in a sense, it does what has sometimes been called post-documentary or post-reportage. It's a kind of aftermath photograph that is looking at the site after sort of all the sort of media outlets have left, and to sort of take stock of what remains. And what he found in this, and what really drew him to the sites and really became his sort of focal point, was the setting itself, but in particular, the setting in which people had left messages. So the graffiti on different buildings. And in a way, you know, one of the things we talk about and we'll talk about today, I'm sure, has to do with ethics of representation. And one can think about this kind of work in ethical terms, because this is one example, anyways, in which the citizenship gets to speak back. And in which the sort of magnitude is measured not in scale, not in horrific images, but in the words of the people who are there on the ground actually living through it. Picture after picture, layered after with one kind of information after another. So we have a trailer overturned that says, fuck you. And then in the foreground, we have a baby's crib. So in a way, what's being revealed here in these layered photographs is a kind of measurement of citizen response, but also of community impact. I would call this sort of gallows humor. It's one of the amazing things about something like a flood is the way in which objects get picked up and sort of thrown about and moved downstream somewhere else and dropped down again, like the house in The Wizard of Oz. And so there's that reference there, but also in the background we see an upturned car. And those upturned cars or boats that sit on the roofs of buildings or things that aren't where they're supposed to be, that kind of juxtaposition of normalcy with the abnormal is really one of the fundamental tropes of the disaster site. And this plays out a lot, I find, in these car pictures, which, you know, Robert Polidori, also pictures from New Orleans, Dominic Gnarr, who's a Ryerson graduate from the photo program, had photographed the Japanese tsunami, but with these cars that sort of like, almost like as if they were placed there in some kind of still life. The one thing, I'm going back to Mishrash here, who also has many car photographs in his site, but because he is focused on the graffiti that's also part of the photograph, it points to something beyond the frame. And that's, I guess, the sort of final point I just want to make is that, you know, so many of these, so much of what is in the disaster is outside of the frame of the photograph. In this case, the word sorry is referencing the fact that many people didn't have flood insurance in their policies, and so they weren't supported. There were claims and court cases about the flood being an act of God, and if it's an act of God as opposed to a human engineered disaster, the coverage is denied. So these are ways of talking back, not just to the disaster, but to the institutionalized response of the disaster at the same time. And in all cases, really pointing beyond the photograph and to perhaps something like politics, economics, or we might even say ethics. Thanks.
Thank you, Blake. Can you hear me? Yeah? So? Peter's up next.
Yes, thank you. All right. Promise to stay under 10 minutes. Here's a picture. There's the picture, pardon me. San Francisco earthquake, 1989. I had left the Associated Press in New York, came back to Canada, Maclean's magazine, July 89. In October 89, earthquake in San Francisco during a baseball game. The next morning, I came into work. The editor says, why aren't you on your way to San Francisco? I got on the next plane. I got there in time that evening to take this picture of my body being recovered. And then I spent the next day just everywhere I could. It was a major catastrophe, but 63 people died. You know, there were hundreds of thousands in other areas. But this particular, and this most serious loss of life, was on this bridge. Which pancake? Now, this isn't the pancake version, but this is the area that I found in a helicopter. Everybody had already published the other pictures. We were there 2 days late. We're a weekly magazine. Here's a car that was crushed by an apartment that used to be on the second floor. We found the couple that we photographed, and that's what we put on the cover. And what was interesting is that someone wrote a letter to the editor congratulating Maclean's for having concentrated on the human aspect of this earthquake rather than the loss of property, which both Newsweek and Time had published on their covers, burning buildings. Tsunami, Banda Aceh. You remember the tsunami? You don't remember. Most of you were still in grade school, but this was in 2004, Boxing Day. But a week and a half later, I got a call from World Vision offering me a seat on a plane, two seats actually, for a reporter and I. CBC already had Evan Solomon aboard, and so we flew into Jakarta, where they transferred the goods from an Air Canada plane to cargo planes, and then I flew by helicopter into Banda Aceh. Here are two boats that were in the ocean a few 2 weeks before, but now they're about 3 miles inland. This is what it looked like in many parts of Banda Aceh. That's the scene that really impressed a lot of people, and that all the buildings that were surrounding this mosque have been washed away, never mind knocked over. They were knocked over and washed away like matchsticks, yet this mosque survived. This is the first person I photographed, a woman who had driven something like 200 miles from her home inland to Banda Aceh because her daughter and son-in-law lived there with two children, and this is the area where she expected to find them. Obviously, they were lost. A lot of people brought out pictures of loved ones. There's a little guy at the hospital. And while I was at the hospital, I was allowed to wander around. The thing is, Catherine mentioned earlier about asking permission. Usually when I go to a disaster, or I mean, I haven't been to that many, but a developing world event, I'm usually with an NGO. And they have already spoken to the people who run the place. This photographer is okay, let him do what he needs to do. It's going to help us. And so I was able to just photograph people in misery, which is unfortunate. But this fellow here was not necessarily a victim of the disaster per se, in that he was very ill. He needed oxygen full time, but because of the shortage, he was put on oxygen 20 minutes on, 20 minutes off. I looked into a doorway and I saw this woman kissing her sister. I found out it was her sister afterwards, and I came back about half an hour later, and she was gone. And so it was tragic. Here I walked by this room, and I looked in, and I knew what that was under that blanket. I took one frame, and as I took that picture, the click gave me away. The lady just looked up and then looked down again. Again, because I was with NGOs, people are more forgiving. And, you know, it's in the moment, I'm not wondering whether I'm upsetting someone. I'm after the picture. If you're writing a story, you can see it and walk away and write about it. As a photographer, if you don't have the picture, it didn't happen in some cases. This is the bodies that were collected, like this one, and they were burnt. This was taken on the last day that I was there. I was only there about a week. Here's a group of people who had traveled 2 days from the mountains, and here they're crossing over into the populated area. And when they landed, my reporter had a bottle of water with him, and one of those people said, pointed at it, so yeah, sure, here. And he took it down in one swig, and that's when we realized these people haven't had any water for how many days. And we happened to have 2 cases of water in the trunk. So we opened up the trunk and handed them out to everybody. And it was a feel-good moment. Lining up for water, which was brought in by NGOs. And we had the Australian military there cleaning water for them. Of course, there wasn't very much water for bathing. And so a rainstorm will really be helpful. And of course, the military bringing in supplies. Here's a child that had almost drowned, was rescued, but had sand, swallowed sand. And so they had to medevac her. And we don't know what the results were. this is 2 weeks after. And so what people were doing is collecting bodies and just wrapping them up and leaving them on the side of the road. Many of them had come from quite a distance. Nepal, 2 years ago, Nepal earthquake. A friend of mine, a journalist, Sally Armstrong, had been talking to some people at Plan International, and they were convincing her it'd be a good story to cover, and so we decided we'd go. Sally brings me along every once in a while, and so we went to Nepal. We were only there for a week. I slept outside. Most people were still sleeping outside a month after the first earthquake because they didn't trust their buildings. This is a school. Two stories. 106 children went to this school. Not one of them died because it happened on a Saturday. Can you imagine this building? It's women lining up for supplies, food. And it's one thing about these disasters, it's the women who don't survive. The numbers are that women don't survive because they can't swim as well. And they're busy taking care of their children. The men survive. I couldn't resist this little girl, those eyes. We told the NGO that we wanted to photograph a birth because disasters, doesn't matter. You know, they might stop selling at the, you know, food at the store. Electricity might be gone, but people are still having babies. And so we convinced this hospital, and you can see the tents. The hospital was not safe. So they had put some tents up to operate on patients and to have post-op. And it's 5 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call from the doctor. He says, we're gonna have a birth in an hour. I showed up, I stayed at the doorway, and it happened. So, not much I can tell you. I'd be happy to answer some questions after Ed has his time. I'm gonna shut this down. One thing, preparation, someone asked. I bring a couple of bottles of Purell. I don't carry them on the plane. They're in checked baggage. I carry, you know, little packets of Kleenex, about this thin. I carry 6 or a dozen of those because you never know when you're gonna need them, and there's no toilet paper. And a sleeping bag, because in both Nepal and Banda Aceh, I slept in my sleeping bag. Ed, are you ready?
Thank you, Peter.
You got it. It's actually, hold on. I think it has to. Wait, sorry, 1 second. Just have to make sure it doesn't crossfade, didn't loop until it crossfades. Okay. Hi, my name is Ed. It's good to be here. Thank you, everyone, for having me. Can everyone hear me right now?
All right, speak.
So I just wanted to share a project that I did. Actually, this is one of the first projects I ever did outside of uni. I don't necessarily cover disasters. A lot of the work that I do is post-conflict and conflict-related, but I think the tenets of covering conflict, post-conflict, and disasters are more or less, they're very similar. And I think one thing for me that is really important is to, be there and be there for the breaking news, but also stay long enough to show the lasting effects of any disaster or conflict. And really put a human face to, what is at stake. So this is a project that I did in Kazakhstan. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union test-fired over 400 nuclear weapons in Kazakhstan in this open steppe, which is about the size of Italy. And about 2 million people were exposed to radiation through nuclear weapons testing. This would be the equivalent, this would be the same as Nevada or the Pacific Islands. But in this case, this is a place where the Soviet Union actually knew that there were civilians in this area, mostly Kazakhs, and exposed them to radiation throughout many decades. And so when I went there, I found these characters who had been exposed to radiation, and these people, radiation and the effects of it translates through generations. So people are still being born to this day, suffering from the effects. And so one thing, this is Barak, and so in a story like this where the images are very sensitive and representation is oftentimes can be taken out of context, I tried to spend as much time as I could with people to get a sense of who they are as people. So you meet someone like Barak, and he's born without eyes and can't really see and has a very deformed face, but instead of seeing him as a disability, I ask him, what is it that makes you happy? Like, tell me about who you are as a person. And he told me that he really likes playing piano. And so I asked, can I just stay in your house long enough so you can, do your thing? And I want to see what your life looks like. And so I try as much as I can to empower people so they aren't seen as victims, but as people with their own agency. So, for example, this kid, when I met him, he was 18 at the time, Nikita. He was born without the ability to move or speak. He can move, but he can't speak or really control his hands. So his father made a stick for him out of supplies, and he could type. And so online, he's fully conscious and has an entire world on the internet. And actually, shortly after this image was taken, he met another person who was disabled on the internet, and he actually married a girl in Russia, and they're actually doing really well. But at the same time, there are a lot of long-standing issues. So if you're looking at something like radiation, which doesn't have an actual photo, you have to really step back and think beyond the normal frames that you would make to take a portrait of a town or of an area that has been affected. And oftentimes, the strongest image isn't what you would think it is. It's very subtle truths. A child who was born also with the effects of radiation, what does it feel like for a mother to have to try to care for them even to this day? And so this, for example, is the area where where structures were built for the sole purpose of nuclear testing. And so this is in what they call the polygon, where actually to this day you can touch the ground in the middle of winter and parts of rocks and areas are still warm from the radiation. Working there was really, it was hard because there wasn't exactly anything to photograph. You're kind of just spending time with people to paint a portrait of what life looks like, and that's a repeat, and to humanize people in their daily lives, but also give a sense of what's at stake. And for me, looking at the story, I was pretty shocked that very few people, myself included, knew anything about this place. People talk about Chernobyl, and after the tsunami, people talk about Japan, but to this day, very little is understood about what happened during Soviet nuclear testing. And so, this is a mosque where someone was born handicapped. And an image like this shows to me community and how people, regardless of how they're affected, are still a part of their community. And I think one thing to remember is that no matter what happens in any situation, whether it's a conflict or whether it's a disaster, you know, life does go on in its own very special way. And I think as a journalist who's been covering, working internationally for the last 10 years or so, one thing that's really struck me is just how resilient the human spirit is. And I think we oftentimes as journalists have a tendency to go in and see people and we're trying to extract a tragedy or a narrative of ourselves out of them. But really what we see is hope. So for example, this girl right here, she can't walk because she was born without the ability to do so because of radiation. But her mother teaches her to dance with her hands, and she puts on recitals and shows for people. This is a concert for, again, so many people who are affected by radiation. And you know, I think if we can, these are people who are born deaf, but then they had a concert where they sign language to each other. And I think one thing that's really humbling about being in situations like this is that you see that just people are strong, and the same after any conflict or disaster, we expect that people will be sad, we expect that people will have a lot that they're dealing with, and that's all true. But at the same time, like, it doesn't take so long for people to still become people. You know, I visited refugee camps in Iraq or Turkey where, you know, like, people have fled conflict, but they're still worried about the basic things that we would all be worried about: having a good future for your kids, who they're going to marry, what kind of job opportunities they have. All those things still exist. They don't really go away. So I think one thing that's really important for journalists when you're looking at these humanistic situations is to see the person beyond the tragedy. And that's basically it. So this is Nikita with his brother. And and that's about it. This is actually a really interesting scene. This is a rehabilitation center. So people who are born with autism can actually stimulate themselves with LED lights. And so one thing that's really important is also to look for, moving forward, what are solutions? You know, what do people need, and what is it that people, that grounds people? So it's not just tragedy after tragedy, because I think if you want people to feel something, you need to get people to connect with them as human beings. And I think there's a tendency for us here in the West to exotify places abroad, internationally. And so for me, I don't really think about where I am. I try as hard as I can to think about the people in front of me, as opposed to, I am from Canada, I'm going to this foreign country. But just think of it as you're a human being talking to another human being. And you try to do whatever you can to bridge a language divide, a cultural divide, a religious divide, or a national divide. And it is tough sometimes because we are, just by being in this room, being in Canada, we are inherently privileged with a very specific lens. And so that's never going to go away, but we need to be able to recognize that we are going into places, and if we do it wrong, we're either exploiting, but if we do it right, we're trying to bridge some sort of an understanding so there could be both political change or any sort of like a reason to be there. So that's, I think, the question that we all need to ask ourselves if we go into a disaster area or a conflict area is, why are we going? What is the point of us being there that a citizen journalist with a phone or someone can't represent? And I think that's, before we rush into places, we just need to think long and hard about why we're all here in the first place.
Hello? Good? Thank you three so much. That was incredible. I think we can all agree. Holy crap. So my first question I'm going to ask to the whole table. Journalists love talking about ethics. I think one of the things that you've all simultaneously covered is the fact that ethically, photojournalists need to look, you know, at the scene they're covering and say, should I be taking this photo? Should I be capturing this person who is, you know, lying here dead? Should I be capturing this birth, let's say, that is possibly private? Peter, I'll start with you. What do you think the ethics are surrounding coverage like this?
I think in the over the years, I've traveled to over 80 countries. Half of them have been in the developing world. And there's a big difference. If I'm walking around in Toronto, I don't point the camera at anyone just to take a picture. If I'm traveling in a developed country, generally it's been with the aid of an NGO. Might be an American or a Canadian NGO, but they have people on the ground who are locals, they speak the language, and they have already, in most cases, let everyone know this fellow is okay, he's working with us. Also, as tragic as it is, a lot of people are shell-shocked. And, you know, you do feel ghoulish in taking advantage of them. But on one hand, I'm there to take pictures to show the world. One thing about the tsunami, Indonesia, I came back after a week. I printed up about 30 prints, large prints, and I posted them in the Brookfield Place, that lobby, and World Vision put up an envelope or a little box with pamphlets and envelopes so that people could donate money, and they did. And so, you know, you pick up the paper 2 days after a disaster, and they've all got ads plastered with a tragic photo of a child or whatever, and they want everyone to contribute. As tragic as it is, that's when these agencies make their most money, is after a major disaster. And so I thought that by posting these photographs, large prints, I was doing a little bit to help the people that I had taken advantage of. And I say it today, I wouldn't have said it back then. But yeah, you know, we do, the media does take advantage of disaster.
I guess, can you hear me? Yeah, I think ethically, like I said, when there is a disaster, I think what we have to do is we have to call attention to what's happening so that people, so that can inform what charities to donate to, what action your government, whether you're in Canada or the US or wherever, what the response should be. And I think I see journalism as a function of democracy in the sense that if you see something that you want your government to change, or if you see a disaster that you want your government to respond to, your individual voice is part of that democracy to say that the Canadian government should donate to this cause or aid in this relief or stop selling weapons to a certain country. That's the power that individual citizens have, and what we do as journalists are an extension of that power to let people be informed of that. So I think if you keep that in mind ethically, then it's easier for me to feel like I'm not exploiting the person in front of me, but amplifying this person's pain so that the world can react in a productive way. Recently, and this is not to do with conflict, but I was just covering the drug war in the Philippines, and this came up every single day where we would photograph the brutal aftermath of a tragedy, and you would have to stick yourself, without meeting someone, you would photograph someone at their worst moment where they're seeing a dead relative on the streets. And it's a horrible position to be in, to have to take advantage of that. But in the back of my head, I'm always thinking, like, the world absolutely needs to see this so that maybe there can be a discussion about whether this drug war is working. And so I think that's just something that if you internalize it enough and understand why you're doing it, that's the only ethical... That's the only ethic that you can follow. One thing I did want to say, Peter, is that I guess I disagree a little bit on embedding ourselves too much only with NGOs, because it's important to recognize that international groups like MSF or the UN or World Vision have their own agendas, whether it's like fundraising or, you know, or not propaganda, but like their outreach. And so oftentimes, like, I'm really adamant that we as journalists need to keep our independence, because one day we might be reporting on the UN or the Red Cross and looking at, let's say, how much money they wasted in Haiti, for example. And so if we ally ourselves or embed ourselves too much with these NGOs, you know, we lose our independence. And I think that's something that I'm trying to be very cognizant of as well.
Well, since you're attacking me.
Oh, sorry, no, I'm not attacking
you. No, you know, it's a valid point. I don't disagree.
But if you're working for a wire service, you know, you have to get the pictures out that day, the very day. Working for a magazine, even so, it's a weekly deadline, but I still had to get the pictures out. Water takes the path of least resistance. If you're traveling on a project that you expect to spend 2 months with, obviously you can handle that on your own. But if you, we used to call, when I worked for the AP, we used to call them firemen. You know, you're, the guy based in Kansas City would end up in Indonesia covering a major catastrophe because he was good at it, and that's why he was sent. He had to get the pictures out the same day. And if it means talking to an NGO, you know, I don't remember working for an NGO that had propaganda. The only propaganda I sensed was they were collecting money, obviously, to fund their cause, and they were doing good work. If someone told me you can't take that picture because it makes us look bad, and I have had that situation occur, I argue with them and I don't follow their rules. When we accept their help, it's with the condition that we are the editorial arbiters of what we're doing.
Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just add, I think those are all really good points, and I think that this is one of those big issues in journalism and documentary and photography. It's a big issue because the stakes are high. We're talking about people at their most vulnerable. And as Ed said too, I mean, and this is a person with a camera coming from a position of privilege in relation to the subject, but I would say perhaps it's also, a kind of privileged response to decide not to shoot, because in a way that's also a retreat from one's responsibility to the other that is there in front of you, and is looking at you, looking for some sort of response. And often people will look to journalists to really be their witness, because they're not perhaps in a position to be their own witness. So it's a complicated bit of business. One of the questions that I like to pose with my students in documentary, which I think is relevant here too, is always just to ask the question, what does that privilege lead to? What in taking those photographs will change for the subject, if anything will change for the subject? And if nothing's changing for the subject, then that does raise certain particular ethical problems that, you know, that are worth addressing and thinking about.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you can hear me, right? I keep asking you this question. Okay. So this question is directed to both Peter and Ed. Blake, you're welcome to chime in. But we've heard from Catherine Porter at the beginning of this panel that, you know, sometimes she just found herself crying on scene, and the photos you showed us, rather, were extremely emotional. What were you feeling in those moments, or do you recall a certain moment where you kind of just, it was almost unbearable for you to take those photos?
In the moment when I'm working, not that I'm heartless, but it doesn't affect me. Other than it affects me in that I'm saddened by the disaster, the loss of life, the misery, and I live so well here in Canada, but I don't choke. Now, today I had a good day. I showed all those pictures, and there are a few of those that I sometimes, when I'm showing them, I have to pause for a moment just to clear my throat. And sometimes I just have to think about it, and I'll feel it. I mean, I got sappy when the Khan family was being attacked, the Gold Star family, when they were being attacked by Trump. I'm watching a sad movie, and, you know, my wife says, you know, she can see I'm feeling odd about it. And I think part of that is that my age, I think as you get older, you get more sappy. As a young man, I don't remember being that concerned. You know, it was yesterday and I'm on to something else. But no, in the moment, I don't think I stopped to say, I feel really bad about this. At the end of the day, when I'm sending the pictures back, I might feel a little beglemped, but it's not that, I don't think I could work if I was gonna stop every 5 minutes. Now, Again, as a photographer, you've got this thing in your hand, and you've got to be pointing, you've got to be thinking about exposure, focus, composition, and that comes first. So obviously, I'm not going to stop and really ponder how sad the moment is.
When I started, when I started covering conflict and disasters in 2006, so this is 11, 12 years ago, I kept on thinking to myself, well, whatever I'm feeling at this moment, seeing the aftermath of an Israeli airstrike in Lebanon, for example, how could anything I feel possibly compare to the person in front of me? And I think about that, and I used to use that as a way to block myself from feeling the right to feel anything. And I would think, no matter what, at the end of the day, I get to go home, and I get to just live my life again, and I chose to be here, and I chose to do this. Whereas the people in front of me will forever be affected by this. And that was like a really good shield for me for a while, but then after a while, year after year after year, that principle of not being affected and trying to defer to someone else's emotions, not feeling that right, not being able to feel that right to feel, kind of just wears away. And it's actually, it gets harder and harder the older you get because it becomes very cumulative, the effects of trauma and the things that you see. And the weird thing is it actually affects me, I find, in, it's when I'm back in the West or back home in Jerusalem, New York right now, it's only when you're back in your normality that you realize just how abnormal your experiences were. And I think to me, coming back is the weirdest experience, and that's what's actually really hard. In fact, when you're editing your video or your footage, like in the same space that your what you associate with home has actually been, that's the hardest thing. When you're there in the field, everything is new and everything is different, but it's that jump between those two where it's I don't know how to deal with, and it's still been quite a struggle.
Well, I think that's really interesting that when you're in the field, you're sort of in reaction mode, but when you're back home, you're front and center with the radical difference between two worlds, and it's hard to really place yourself in between those spaces. So I can well imagine that, but you were asking those two, so I just jumped in.
No, go for it. That's okay.
I'd like to say one thing. Several years ago, the 50th anniversary of D-Day, I went to Normandy with a Canadian soldier, Charlie Martin, Queen's Own Rifles, short, stocky guy, and I read his book before going, and I thought I had not even met him yet. And I was reading this book, and I was thinking, if they ever did a movie with this guy, they'd have to get Bruce Willis, you know, Die Hard 44, because he was just marvelous. And then when we got to meet him, and we were traveling through, following his steps the first day that he landed on the D-Day, we went to a cemetery. It happened again. He says, he started to cry. And he apologized. I said, no, don't. You know, I stood back with a long lens taking pictures. And he apologized afterwards. And he said, you know, it's been 50 years. And it's only when I think of it and I'm seeing his best friend when they landed. You know, he was 10 feet on the beach and the mine hit him and he was gone. And he says, it's when you relive it in your head.
Thank you, Peter. I mean, yeah, there you go. It's hard. It's hard work what you do, but you guys do an incredible job. And I'm really thankful that you got to show some of your work to all of us. Did you want to step in? Ed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that... That gets you thinking. It is important when you come back to really think about and take stock of, like, what it is that you've just seen. And I think it's never what you think it is. It's always going to be the most random triggers that affect you in the weirdest way possible. It's like a smell. It's a random, you know, like working in the Middle East for a long time, like ISIS and all their execution videos have ruined the color orange to me, that every time I see this color, I react to it. Like, I was in Parkdale a year ago, and there was some air show that was happening, and I had no idea you would react in that way to hearing the sound of fighter jets. And I just found myself shaking and really upset. And then I kept on telling myself, like, I'm in Toronto. I'm not in Gaza. I'm not in Lebanon. I'm not in Somalia. How am I feeling this right now? And I was with my friend, and I ran into a closet. And actually, I left Toronto because of this air show, because I just don't want to hear the sound of these fighter jets. And it's the weirdest thing, because that happens, and when you were there, you never really thought about any of that, except the ethics of what you were trying to represent in front of you. But then you come back, and it's really weird. So if you're going out, really think about long-term, and people have talked about this in the other discussion, like, how are you being affected? And because if you can't do your job, if you are too affected, then in the next thing that you cover, you're going to bring that baggage with you, and that's not fair to the subjects who have nothing to do with your past.
Well, I'll just add one little thing. But I think it's what Ed and also what Peter's talking about is the belatedness of trauma. And people who do work on trauma talk about the sort of after effects, that the traumatic experience isn't really an experience that's had in the moment. It's something that is stored behind, and it returns later. And it's sometimes like a trigger, like the color orange or something, quite out of the blue and quite not expected. Will flash back to whatever the event might be, and so that's really one of the kind of conditions of the traumatic response, is that it's a belated response that returns later.
I really hate to do this because we're getting to the good stuff right now, but I do have to wrap this up. A little bit of a plug here. So we're actually hosting a bit of a gallery at 5, not a bit of a gallery, it's a gallery, at 5 at the Image Arts Center, and it's going to feature Peter and Ed's work, as well as a lovely photojournalist by the name of Michelle Sue. She couldn't make it here today because she had a gig and she's kicking all sorts of ass, but just to let you know, there are really amazing women in this field. We couldn't get them here today, but they're around. Thank you to these awesome men who came as well.
Thank you.
Ed.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Oh. You're welcome.
Thank you.
So check that out. It's going to be awesome. Their work is on display. I don't know if we have time for questions. I may have. Yeah. I'm sorry, guys and gals. But thank you again for coming out. We really appreciate it. And round of applause, please.
No, I don't know.